Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about games with only one player. We are still in the era of COVID, so we hope that all of our viewers are still safe and secure and possibly sheltering like we are. So among our considerations is you might possibly have reduced access to a number of players. You might be on your own at the moment, or you might have a roommate or a small family that you're with at the moment. And so we were kind of thinking about ways that you could get a D&D game running with just maybe one player, one DM. Some people do that, or possibly solo, or maybe you are going to test out running D&D online for the very first time and you kind of want to dip your toe into it on a small scale before you do something really crazy. So games with just one player is what we're talking about today.
So the interesting fact here is that Dan and I just recently did this on Tuesday, mostly just for fun and also as an excuse to try out some of the virtual tabletop software out there. We grabbed Roll20 and one of the D&D solo modules and together played a solo module, which is really intended for one person to play. And we're kind of weirdly bending the rules by having two players cooperatively play that one player experience.
But it's really nice. It's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, we're honestly having fun, and it's interesting to converse about, to share our ideas about why we're picking the things.
When I pitched this to Dan, I mentioned there's an analogy used in video game development a lot of the two gamers on a couch style of play. The notion being, you've made a single player game, like look at something like, I don't know, Breath of Wild, right? Zelda Breath of Wild, clearly single player adventure RPG game with a lot of RPG elements and puzzle elements and whatnot. Fair number of folks are playing this with two people sitting on the couch. One person's actually actively controlling it, but they're kind of playing cooperatively where the other person is watching very actively. They're coordinating. How do we strategize? How do we play? They're maybe making up their own little fiction and fun times and whatnot about it. And you can really play any solo game in that style. And personally, I think it's way more fun.
Yeah. I really hadn't experienced that until you mentioned it. I will say that, you know, growing up in a very, very rural location without anybody that I could meet with regularly, I spent a lot of time taking games that weren't meant to be solo and figuring out ways of making them to be solo, actually, including Risk or Awful Green Things from Outer Space or things like that. And of course, it works best in those board gamey type things. It works best if there's no hidden information, and then I can totally just sit on the opposite side of the board and put on the other hat and do pretty well with that.
Interesting.
But that's nice to actually go in the other direction, take a game that was for one player, play it with multiple people, and that's actually a little bit new for me, so I'm glad that you told me about that.
It's kind of funny, you and I have a kind of a similar but slightly different personal experience from our youths.
Yeah.
I also got into D&D and had literally no one around me who wanted to play it. And my angle was, rather than trying to morph games into solo play, is I very actively hunted for games that were meant to be played solo. So I'll actually have a lot of anecdotes about that, and I guess we'll be evoking a lot of 12-year-old Paul and 10-year-old Dan in this in this episode of Wandering DMs.
There's a website called Tower of Infinite Evil by a gentleman named Thomas S. And so, in researching this episode, he has a really helpful post actually, specifically about all the one-on-one D&D adventures that kind of helped me make sure I wasn't missing any to begin with. And so the subtitle, I noticed this morning that the subtitle of his blog is the best year for D&D is 12.
That's great. That's
and great. I'm not sure I totally agree with it, but it's a funny observation. It's pretty clever. Yeah. So let's not right. So I think I'm going to talk D&D a little bit, if that's okay for
sure.
The show.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's her. Yeah.
So I think that the very first attempt at, like, you want to play D&D, but you don't have the 20 to 50 players, which is recommended in the original book. Was I think about 1975, right, in Strategic Review, which was the predecessor to Dragon Magazine, they had a two-page just solo randomized dungeon generator where you all alone, just one single person, sort of playing DM and player, could randomly roll dice to see what the next corridor or the room or the monster or the treasure was. And so that solo random dungeon generation was in that magazine about 75. And then it got folded into the first edition DM's Guide, pretty much unchanged, in 1979, I guess. But it's basically the same thing that they had since 75. So I have spent some time, trying to run that. And yeah, my assessment is it doesn't work great. It doesn't work super fantastic. The random maze generation tends to do this like fractal kind of spiral in on itself, and then you get teeny tiny little, you're supposed to fit whatever you can, so you wind up getting little 10-foot squares with like secret doors all between them. That's kind of ugly to look at, honestly. And I have a super high body count, because if you have a single PC adventuring, no matter what you do, one single poison spider or one single, first level magic user with a sleep spell will put you down and end your day like that. So as much as I've tried to finagle the rules to make that useful, it hasn't been great. We had Jim, right? So Jim of WebDM appointed a couple weeks back to an alternate rule set that's added onto that to kind of buffer your single player a little bit better. As far as you get put down like that, and then you switch to a table, it's like, what kind of weird transaction got you out of the dungeon and kept you alive, kind of thing. I can't remember what that's called, like the Red Book edition or something like that. So anyway, that was the first attempt, and I would say that it didn't go super great.
Well, there you go. There's Ash actually commenting that that he was going to ask you about this exact use case.
Yeah, I have tried. I mean, I tried about a dozen times of running that. And I mean, some people say they have a good experience with that random dungeon generation. And I think it was a good first attempt. But I have not super fond memories of it, actually. The maps look super freaking ugly when you get them made. So I tried tinkering with it, and I'm not super happy with it.
Well, let me start with my first ever solo experience playing D&D. I'm going to jump over here, and that's M Solo 1. Yep. Can't read the title. It's so small.
It's Blizzard Pass by David Cook.
Yep.
From 1983.
Yep. So interestingly, this is a module, basic D&D module that was intended for one thief, and the way they kept the information secret was with magic pen, if you remember that. So a lot of big blank boxes, and you would color it in and reveal the numbers, or reveal the text, as the case may be. And of course, the problem with this is that basically that makes it a one-use product, and then now you've ruined it, right? I recall spending a lot of time with this module as a kid, even to the point, I think, of using my 8086 computer to transcribe all of the text from the revealed boxes into a word processor so I could print them out and then, like, obscure them from myself. So I could replay it without having to stare at the book and see all the answers right there in the book.
Well, I will say, so this is a little bit of a, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I will say that among the obvious, right, how do you get a solo D&D play is use a computer to do the DM adjudications and the secret information. And so at least since the very inception of D&D in 74, people were trying to do that to make that experience possible. And I'll also say, like me, like I have a war game called Bismarck, right? And among my earliest programming efforts was to write an AI for the German player so that I could play the British player against my computer game, actually.
Fascinating.
So I think for many of us, in fact, possibly the reason we got into programming, actually, was in order to provide this solo play experience. That's right. That's personally why I know about programming in the first place.
So full tangent now. I once in college sat down, we were playing this game, we found this card game called Plague and Pestilence, which was a lot of fun.
Right.
And the rules are fairly simplistic, and I was getting into programming, and I thought, I'm going to program a video game version of this, and naturally, when doing so, I was like, I'm going to have to write an AI so I have something to play against. And my problem with doing that is, after analyzing the game deeply and writing the algorithm for how the AI plays the game, I realized there was one right way to play the game, and I then implemented that algorithm whenever I played, and then realized I had made the game completely rote, and was like, this is no longer fun.
This is a point that I made on Twitter, like maybe about 2 months ago. Like, I made a post on Twitter specifically about, we are in the age of, now we're in the age of machine learning, and does that immediately make all board games immediately trivial strategy-wise? Can we just take any standard classic board game, run it through machine learning, come up with the optimal strategy, and then not want to play it anymore? And I had someone that kind of, I had pushed back a little bit against that, but I feel, part of me feels like that's actually a legitimate general problem now, actually.
Yeah. So this is I think one of the problems that any solo adventure writing comes into with any role-playing game, whether it's D&D or otherwise, is that the author has to predict every possible move that the player may take and pre-author every possible outcome.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And that's hard.
And it's specifically the opposite of what the role-playing genre gives you of anything's possible.
Right. Yeah. So I find the best ones, for example, the one you and I are playing right now is Be Solo, and that one, I think, goes the extra mile in sort of adding handlers for a lot of different variations. As you and I saw, we tried to enter the complex from two different directions, and the first thing it asked was, do you want to turn invisible? Do you want to use gaseous form? Do you want to just walk in normally? And immediately, you know, Dan, I think your spidey senses, your designer spidey senses were going, we should do that because it's actually important for this period.
Right.
And then we tried the second entry and it gave us the same options.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's, you're always going to get those options when entering because it's always an option.
Yeah.
Right. But it's always a consideration when entering for the first time of how do I do it the most stealthy way.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I like about Be Solo. Is that it feels a little more open than, say, M Solo 1, which feels almost a little more like a choose-your-own-adventure, where, you know, it's very forked paths, and there are wins and losses, and there you go.
Let me point out one thing about the... Can you bring the image up just one more time of Blizzard Pass there?
Yep.
So if you look in the top left there, right, it's actually published. So you Paul, just referred to this as M Solo. But in the top left corner, the code that's actually there is actually M1, which is among the more confusing things, because they reuse that exact code for a module 2 years later in the Beckme Masters line. They used M1, M2, M3 for that separately. So so after the fact, we have all come to refer to this as M Solo 1.
Really fascinating, because we were just talking about B Solo, and I'm going to flip to that one. It's actually called B Solo.
Right.
Does that mean B Solo was published after M Solo 1, possibly?
That is correct, 1 year later.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, because frankly, I think the writing is better. Like, they learned some things. M Solo would not be my first choice. Unfortunately, as a 12-year-old, M Solo was the one and only one of these things I had.
Yeah. That was actually the first one in that line. So they were kind of figuring out what to do and also discovering that they made a terrible mistake in what they coded it with.
Now, B Solo also does away with the ink pen. And now you just have kind of classic choose your own adventure style writing where the blocks of text have been jumbled and letter coded. So you're jumping around the book a lot. And that's actually, I think, a much better way to hide the information. So you're not just like immediately looking going, okay, well, that's the outcome. So obviously I choose A versus B. Now it's like, oh, I got to jump to this page or that page. There's the physical barrier of jumping pages, which is really nice.
It helps for reusability that you're not physically defacing the module as the first time you go through it with the ink pen. It's similar to the choose your own adventures that were being published at the time and obviously working perfectly fine. So those first M Solo 1 and 2 were using the invisible ink, and they never used it again. So they used this. There were things even a couple years after this where they had text that was mangled with red coloring, mm-hmm. and you had to use a red piece of acetate to cover it up, block off the red, and then you could actually read it. And again, at least you're not – so you had to keep this piece of acetate around. If you lost that, you were in trouble. But at least you weren't actually defacing the module as you did it. So there's a CM5. There's a Marvel Superheroes game that works that way a couple years later. But I think that the technique that's in Beast Solo is probably the easiest thing. You don't have to ship extra material with it. You're not at risk of losing it. So it probably is the most straightforward solution of that.
Yep. Real quick, as long as we're on that theme, here's M Solo 2, yep. Again with the pen. And now this one, I own all these now because I'm yep. obsessed, and so I've collected yep. them all. And so the nice thing I've discovered is, of course, this one, my copy of this, there's no pen, it's garbage, you can't read the text, right? It's blown out, it's awful. The good news is, if you just do a quick internet search, you will find all the hidden text. People have transcribed it, as I did when I was 12. People have yep. transcribed it into Word documents or PDFs or whatnot, and you can find this stuff online. So
I will also say that all the I think all the adventures that we're looking at, all the classic D&D adventures that we're looking at here, are available on DriveThruRPG, and I believe that the text that you get on DriveThruRPG is it's all just immediately visible to
it's
you.
It's just immediately visible.
That's I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Okay, we might as well round it out. There's the last one, of course, in this series is X Solo. I've not personally played this one. I am eager to do so because, like everything in the X series, it tries to incorporate wilderness exploration as well as dungeons.
Yes.
And
yes.
that sounds really fascinating, and I'm super curious how they did it. And I haven't read it myself yet. I'm saving this one as a personal yeah. treat to myself to someday Great. Sit down and play.
Great. And just to be perfectly clear, the whole series that we're talking about right now they're all programmed adventures just for one single person yeah. all by themselves. So B Solo, M Solo 1, 2, this X Solo here are just one single person. You don't need a second person running it for you. It's all programmed. And, Paul, there's one more. There's one more. There actually is one more. They
is
did
there?
Actually
make, I thought yeah, it was just four of them.
Yeah, there's an X Solo 2.
Really?
That called, I believe, Thunder Delve Mountain. It's easy to miss because it doesn't say X Solo on it. It says XS2. That's why it's easy to miss. But there's an XS2 that is the sequel to that one year later.
Great.
Yep.
Look forward to getting that. Now,
yep.
Okay, so let's talk again about young Paul searching for this stuff. I never found any of these modules when I was a kid. I had M Solo 1, that's it.
Okay.
However, when I was 15, I went to my first ever Gen Con and discovered Tunnels and Trolls.
Okay.
And didn't really know anything about Tunnels and Trolls, found the books, but what really caught my eye was they have done extensive solo adventures. So
yeah.
I don't have pictures of them because here's my collection of solo adventures for Tunnels and Trolls. There's a lot of them. I played these a lot. These are great. If anything, I would say Tunnels and Trolls is even more simplistic rules-wise, even more rules-light than classic D&D. Yeah, so these make for really good games. Now, the downside to these, the thing that always bothered me as a kid, was I always wanted to try and figure out a way to string them together so I could have one consistent character go through them all. And they're a little kind of hit and miss in that regard. It's a little difficult to string them together in that way.
Okay.
Possibly because as I'm looking at these, I notice that I have like really odd numbers here. I have 20, 22, 23, 9... I don't know. Maybe there's a way to string them together, but I was never able to figure it out.
I mean, you know, if you look at the DCC series, right? I mean, yeah. they're all individual things, and they're not intended to be like a series or anything like that. So I feel like that's kind of a later idiom to intentionally be stringing things together in a master series. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I retract that. Ignore that I just said that. So it's interesting because I'm not that familiar with Tunnels and Trolls, but I think like a year ago at a convention, somehow I picked up a free mini adventure for Tunnels and Trolls, and sure enough, it was for one single player. Was that, I mean, did, was that, were the majority of their adventures all like that for solos?
I wouldn't say the majority, but there were a lot of them. They did a long series of them, and I think they were very popular. I think it was a good seller for them, and so they made a lot of them. Yeah, I this is kind of conjecture on my part, just from the fact of, I remember in that period from about 15 to 18, anytime I went to Gen Con, I would make it a point to go by the Flying Buffalo booth and grab some of these, because that was the one and only place I knew where to get them.
Great. Interesting. So let's switch, if you're okay with that, Paul.
Yep.
Let's switch to talking about classic D&D adventures that are for one DM and one player. So now it's not programmed, but you do have a DM running it. Specifically for one player, which is kind of interesting. And this actually predates, so this actually does predate the programmed modules by a little bit. And so one of my favorites, there's this series called the O series, the O standing for one-on-one. And one of my favorite adventures of all time actually has the O1 label called Gem and Staff. And that is by John and Laurie Vandegraaff, who you don't see their names on any other product in classic D&D. And they were gamers in Detroit. And so this actually was originally, the original version of this was written for a convention, WinterCon in 1978, I believe.
A solo or a one-on-one adventure made for a con?
And it's a tournament.
What? Also,
yeah.
How did they have the people for that?
Well, there you go. So I think that the published version here, which was published in 1983, has two parts. Mm-hmm. I believe the original one was just one of those parts. And you've got a timer, and that timer is 30 minutes. You get started
and
you're playing a fairly high level thief on a solo, you know, heist job, and you have 30 minutes. You got to go in. You got to get the thing. There's a scoring chart. You get a score at the end of how you did, and so you can run a little mini tournament. And I've totally done that. Like within 4 hours, you can run 8 players through it, and you can score the 8 players in a little tiny mini tournament. And I kind of love that.
That's the quick math I was just doing in my head. There was this notion of so in the late 70s, my impression of the tournament scene was that D&D was exploding and everyone wanted to be in the tournament and that they were struggling to keep up with demand, right? That's what I've heard from reading accounts of it and whatnot. There were cases where they would hold tournaments and not everyone would get in, right?
Yep.
Like you had to like wait in line or be lucky or whatever to get through the lotto to get in. Probably because they didn't have enough DMs or the logistics of that big of a tournament were difficult. So here I am thinking, okay, I got 4 hours, I got one DM, I'm going to run a regular tournament. How many players are they going to let into that? Maybe six players.
Maybe
so
eight.
You're going to get maybe 8. Right. So that's the thing, right? With this, with one-on-one, you're not really getting many more, or it's maybe the same. Cause you're going to run for, you just said 8 players. That's if you're super on the ball, I'm going to assume you're going to lose at least 1.5 hour slot to logistics.
You're right. Yep.
And so maybe you're going to run it for 7 players.
Yep.
Yep. I don't think they optimized well there.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is for WinterCon, and these people are clearly, they weren't, you know, TSR staff members. They weren't.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, they weren't part of the company trying to, you know, grow the product, but they came up with their own, you know, their own thing that I adore to death, frankly. I've never seen an adventure like it. I've never seen an adventure that had a 30-minute clock on it.
Yeah, that's super weird.
Yeah, so one-on-one, and you can see the label up there on the cover there. It says one-on-one competition module for one player and one DM. I've totally done this right at my place a number of years ago. Is I had players come one by one to my place and go through this every 30 minutes, and then the players that went through it would stay as spectators, right? So the people would come in. Right, not knowing what was happening, and then the other players would sit there and spectate and watch as the next person did it.
Jeez, Dan, this is this sounds to me like a stream in the making, man. Like,
well, there you go. I agree that, right? And the thing is, my friend John that played with us for a while, Paul, right? You know, had never played D&D until his, you know, I think he was in his 40s actually, when we introduced him. And he had, in some ways, he was always a little bit like unsure about exactly what the process of D&D was or how he should engage with it. And so he was like, you know, trying to get accustomed to it. And I ran him through this alone. And, you know, you just get provided a character. There's no character selection up front. And there's a lot of, it's very puzzly. It's very magical, tricky. You're going into a wizard's tower, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of classical wizard insanity trickery. And John got done with it, and he went, well, that's what D&D should be like all the time. He was, like, really thrilled. He was like, well, why isn't D&D, like, just all this, all the time, like this? Like, all puzzles all the time, and he loved it.
Yeah, that's great.
So for particular players, it's kind of a unique experience, and I really kind of adore it.
Yeah. It's funny, because I've never played one-on-one D&D ever, pretty much ever.
Yeah.
And it always struck me as odd, because you know, the part of D&D that I always love the most is the role play, the player interaction, the story generation, right. I mean, not to say I don't like the other parts as well. I like me some combat. I like puzzles, sure, but with only the DM to role play against, that felt limiting to me.
I will say I get that. I mean, I will say, as I was preparing for this, you know, a couple thoughts crossed my mind is, there are certainly certain character types that, you know, seem to call out for, you know, solitary adventures, specifically thieves, right?
Yep.
So, and this is a perfect example here, is you are playing a thief here on a, you know, solitary heist mission. And so I feel like particularly for the thief character, it kind of calls out for, and many of us, right, we're playing normal D&D, and our thief player, when they're in town, they want to, on their own, go, like, you know, pick a pocket or something like that, right? That's a pretty common instinct.
Yep. And I've certainly done the trope before of, at the table, taking someone aside for 10 or 15 minutes and done a solo thing with them because they're out of sight, out of view of the rest of the party. And now I realize I'm a total liar. There was the one time, my famous face-severing story, where I had a player that I specifically ran a one-on-one session for because in the campaign they had separated themselves from the party and wanted to explore on their own a bit. And I was like, everyone is telling you this, like, everyone told him it's a terrible idea and he's going to die. Yeah. And I was like, I'm willing to do it if you want to do it. And he's like, all right, let's do it. And he died. And his face was severed by evil pixies. And it was very gruesome and delightful.
Yeah. So I guess I want to say a lot more about that. And the other thing is, on the other hand, if you look at, you know, standard, so, you know, original D&D, right, the book says, oh, you know, you read pulp stories like Conan or Elric, something like that. You want to play like that? Here's a game that lets you do that. Yep. Well, obviously, those are all solo characters. And most pulp short stories or novels, there's usually one main significant character that you're following around. So it seems like that's at least in flavor. And I will even say, I think if you go back to the recording of what we did on Tuesday, we, even though our intention was we're going through this together, we kind of fell into this routine of, like, you, Paul, are reading the adventure, and then you're sort of posing to me what the decision should be. So we actually kind of started to fall into this one DM, one player thing a little, even unintentionally.
Sorry, Dan. My voice is echoing a little back at me from your end. If there's something you can tune there, the fact, the interest for me is, of course, I'm not the DM and I don't know what the outcome of the decision is. So then we get that moment of actually talking about it. And there were certainly moments where you and I are discussing the options, and I'm like, no, let's not do that. Let's do this other thing.
Sure.
So I don't think I was quite the DM role, but a little
you're
bit,
right.
a little
I mean,
bit
we were,
in the DM
you're
role
right, but, it can work. I guess my point is it can work. I've seen it work, and it can be pretty nice, actually.
Yep. Yeah.
So the other module in this series, there's one other module, so I guess it would be 84. So it's all kind of the same, you know, when TSR was publishing, it was all this 83, 84, 85, module 02. Which was published from the UK people. So it's got the little UK flag up in the corner there. So module 02 called Blade of Vengeance. Now, this is very different. This is not a 30-minute tournament. This is a full-blown adventure quest that can last several sessions. And here you get not a thief, but you get one single high-level elf character, which is another good option for this, because if you're going to play a single character, you get the fighting skills, you get the magic spells option, you kind of have a large menu of options. And then this character, I'll say, also has a warhorse and two ally war dogs. So you kind of have a teeny little mini party of mostly animals that you're going through. So
that's great.
Wilderness, right? Yeah. It is a wilderness adventure. Yeah. You're going through a large forested area on trails. You're trying to track down, a dragon who's, you know, killed somebody's homeland or something like that. So I was playing this for a number of sessions with disinvited Brooklyn-based artist Isabel Garbani, and we were having a really good time with it, actually. Totally different thing, but again, a wilderness quest, and this also was working very well for us.
Nice.
Yep. So I would recommend that too. Very, very different from 01, but nicely constructed. I really, for some reason, there's something about like the forest trail wilderness scenario whereby it's sort of like a dungeon. You sort of have limited, you know, options of where you're going to go. And there's something that really hits me very nicely about that. It's a wilderness, but you still have constrained options to make it easy for the DM to run it. And for some reason, I really like that. And it also seems mysterious and it feels threatening that you can't just go anywhere. Mm-hmm. There's something that really kind of rings a bell for me on that.
I mean, it'd be interesting, though, to play like an outdoor spoliation style one-on-one game, right? Here we are looking at the outdoor survival board as our background. I'm trying to think of like, well, what's the other option? What's the even more open world one? And that's, you got to have a big open map, right? And big overland open map travel. It'd be interesting. I don't know. It'd be interesting, I think, to do a one-on-one outdoor spoliation game. But would it be more fun than a many-player outdoor spoliation game? I don't know.
I guess we should try it.
Yeah. Okay, so here's my experience of one-on-one D&D play. Again, so as a kid, was super into these solo adventures, solo modules for Thomas and Trolls. Yeah. Also had like all the Lone Wolf adventure books, if anybody remembers those. Is that Steve Jackson Games? Maybe I can't remember who made those, but basically it's a choose your own adventure book, but with some mechanics so that you're rolling some dice, or actually I don't think they use dice. I think they had like weird random number generating tables in the back or something like that. But you had an inventory and it was a little bit more in the direction of a role playing game, but very much choose your own adventure kind of books. Anyway. I love that stuff, was always asking for Christmas and whatnot. So at some point, I was given the one-on-one game books, definitely branded Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Came with two books that appear to be like choose-your-own-adventure-style books. Each person gets one, so it's always two specific personalities. Here we actually see the Fafford and Grey Mouser one. There was another. It was like a druid versus magic user one. There was a fighter versus a dragon one, where one person has got the dragon book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they actually came bound together? Like, how were
they
bound?
They were in, like, a sleeve. Okay. It was two soft cover books that I think were, like, in a sleeve, I think.
Like cardboard? Or
Yeah. I think, if I remember correctly. Unfortunately, these are some of the things that did not survive my childhood, so I don't still have these lying around. But I had a bunch of them. Eventually at some point convinced my older brother to play one of them with me. I would say really dissatisfying. Imagine two people sitting in a room facing across each other. Each is holding a book. And here's the thing, like, basically it plays like a choose your own adventure. Oh, there's a whole bunch of fire trucks going by. So sorry if you can hear that. hope everyone's all right. Basically, it's the style of choose your own adventure, kind of like, you know, sections, and you're jumping around, but you're kind of going back and forth and taking turns jumping back and forth.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to tell the other person, oh, such and such, like, you know, you, if you get to this decision point, or I can't remember, there's some information you gave to the other player where, because your actions were potentially impacting what was going on with them.
Yeah.
And then I think that they always tried to that end in some big climactic scene between the end, too. Okay. But the fact is, the base mechanics of it are two people sitting in a room, one person is reading, and the other person is waiting for their turn to read.
Okay.
It's like,
I feel like this is like, okay, so I feel like this might be good. Like, we're all super aged and we are on the front porch in our rockers, right? And we want things to be a little slower paced. And we're like, we read for a while. We're like, well, mother, you better turn to page 78 now because that's what's happening. maybe that's with our quilts on our on our laps.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Could be. I don't know.
I could imagine. Okay, so let me just spitball here. I could imagine a show which is taped, right? Mm. And so it's taped separately so that the two people involved aren't seeing what the other person is reading. And then you splice it together in one show so the viewer actually sees what was happening on both sides.
Yeah. I mean, that, again, it would be more entertaining for the viewer, I think, than the participant.
Okay, gotcha.
That's my gut on that. Gotcha. I think there are better ways to play one-on-one D&D, gotcha. And this was not it, unfortunately.
I will point out, so that book right there is written by Jim Ward, and the majority in that series was written by Jim Ward. So I think 8 out of the 11 was all Jim Ward. Yep. 1 was written by David Cook. And then there's also 2 in that same series. There's 2 Marvel superheroes ones. So there's a Daredevil versus Kingpin pair. Mm-hmm. And there's also, I think the very last one they did was a Doctor Strange versus the evil Pharaoh pairing. So I think with those kinds of things at the time, they tended to mix up the genres or brands.
Yeah.
That they had available.
Yeah, it's an odd, it was an odd product. That's what I got to say about that.
good to be inventive. That's good to try stuff.
Okay. So from here, maybe we talk a little bit about other games.
So that wasn't the end of. Sorry, you're interrupting. That wasn't the end of TSR's publications like that. So they did have. It's funny, in the companion, right, in the Beckme companion series, there's like about 10 modules, and the one right in the middle, unexpectedly, is for a solo player. So there's a CM5 quest for the Snow Pearls, I think, which is for a solo, really high-level wizard.
Interesting.
And then in the 90s, in the second edition era, they had 8 modules with a code of HHQ for head-to-head quest. It was, again, one DM, one player. And that specifically, they hit each of the main classes. So I think it's called Fighter's Quest and Wizard's Quest and Thief's Quest. And then coming up at the very last thing, because they don't fit very well into D&D, if we're all perfectly honest about it, was Cleric's Quest came dead last. and then they did a part 2 of each of those for a total of 8 modules. Yeah, managed to get fun. That.
you gotta get your zing.
I'm glad everybody's all convinced with my very strong argument about that, but that's totally what happened. Okay, yeah. So Ash's opinion is that the HHQ series was sadly not very good. I don't have any information about it. I have never cracked any of those up open. The second edition era is not really in my wheelhouse. So thank you for. I wouldn't have any information about the quality if it wasn't for that. Yeah. Thank you for that, Ash.
So, okay, other games. I want to talk a little bit about Barbarian Prince. So, right. Barbarian Prince is a solo board game. It's now freely available, right? You can. Okay. I should have done my homework better here. Dan, you and I played this together once in this same style, where it's definitely meant for solo play. But so Dwarf Star. Has released, or it was made by Dwarf Star originally. Somebody released it publicly for free. Anyway, if you just Google Barbarian Prince, you'll find it. You can download all the bits. It's basically just a book and a board. Those are all the bits. Yeah. And you can play it. And I did that. I printed out a big map and we sat down and played it. And it's, it's a little bit more like what I was getting at of that sort of big open world exploration, right? You have a big hex map.
Yep.
And you're moving around, and there's a lot of mechanics around random generation of what might you encounter in this hex.
Yep.
And then there are story elements that are baked into it based on certain actions. And, of course, you have an overall goal of you have to, I think, accrue a certain amount of money or find one of the other secret ways of promoting yourself to regain your throne as the prince of the barbarian world.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I like it.
That was made by Arnold Hendrick. It is fantastic. It's a fantastic game. Yeah. I loved it. I loved playing it. I eventually made an Android game that's loosely based on it, called Road of Kings. You can search my blog and find that if you want to play it. It's a great game. I thought it was a great game.
Yeah, it seems like it has a lot of depth. It has a lot of variety for, you know, fighting or running or negotiating or bribing or, you know, thieving or trying to get a, you know, band of mercenaries together or things like that. It really has the hex map is like big and detailed and has all kinds of interesting variety to it. Like every two or three hexes has some kind of interesting geographic, like tactical choice that you have to make there. And it really has an enormous amount of depth baked into a very small little space. I agree that I like it a lot.
Yeah, I thought that was super fun. And then little bits of story baked into specific locations as you go down some route. You know, if you enter this town and you have this follower and blah blah blah, then you can jump to this section.
Yeah.
So a lot of nice things like that.
I think you'll agree that it's a hard game, right? So it's classic.
It's brutally hard.
It's from the 70s. You do not expect to win. Ever.
Yeah. I mean, honestly,
like it's really hard.
I want to point out, like, just to go back to the B solo thing, I've been kind of joking about this as we played it, but this is totally the absolute expectation of that game is you're not going to make it out alive, and it's built to be replayed multiple times and go out there and be able to find the corpse of your former comrades who have died there and maybe pick up on what they were doing or not. Yeah, very hard games, very hard.
Which is interesting because that's one of the things that has as a longtime player, we can recognize a lot of cushioning that's been built into these games to maintain character personalities a longer amount of time. But initially, it was initially D&D, you probably had 3 hit points and you are possibly quite likely dead the first time you get hit.
Yeah.
So that was among the expectations in the era.
One other game I want to talk about is Warhammer Quest, which I bought in college. I think it came out in 1995. This is the sort of ultimate evolution of a series of games that started with Hero Quest, which is very popular and has some great, very amusing YouTube videos out there about Hero Quest. Great game. HeroQuest, again, tries to sort of, like, make a light dungeon crawl board game that is maybe more approachable version of D&D, right? Where there's still a DM and there's players, but the character sheets are all cards. You're not really writing anything apart from tracking your wounds. You're moving around on a board. It feels a little bit more like a board game, but it's very dungeon crawl, right? It's very dungeon crawl focused. Warhammer Quest takes it to the point of not having a DM anymore. They basically build out the way that the dungeon is broken down into rooms, and so there's cards that generates the dungeon, so the dungeon is randomly generated. The monsters all move on specific algorithms, so there's no need for a DM. And so the interesting thing is, when you buy this game, which I did, it says, like, for 1 to 4 players, and sure enough, there's a solo version of the game. Now, I played it a bunch, and I still, to this day, love playing this. This is, like, my most played board game. It's so beat up that I've, transferred all the parts into a tub because the box disintegrated. absolutely adore this game. I played it once solo. It was not fun.
Okay, interesting.
All right. I think because it just becomes so mechanical, right? It's just I'm moving guys around. I'm fighting stuff. Like, I'm basically playing Diablo in incredibly slow physical way, right? Like, I don't even have a computer to make the math fast.
Gotcha. I will say, I mean, that is hard to make a game that plays both solo and with a bunch of people well. Hmm. You kind of have to probably choose both. And the difference between, like, 6 players and 5 players and 4 players tends not to be very big. The difference between 3 players and 2 players is a really big jump, usually. And then the difference between 2 players and 1 player is, like, just completely night and day.
Mm.
So I will say that if a game's going to support 2, 3, 4 players, it's pretty darn rare that their solitaire option also runs well.
I don't think it was, like, it wasn't mechanically broken or anything, right? It wasn't like I was unable to play.
Yeah.
But I feel like it was dull. And I feel like it was dull in the same, like, at least in the solo choose your own adventure style ones, there are twists and unexpected things happening, right? Yeah. In this game, it's a pretty much straightforward, I'm killing monsters to try and get to the end to get the big treasure and advance my character so I can do it again. And I realized that these games, and all these solo games, the reason I sort of promote the two guys on a couch method of play is that you bring something extra to the game. Even Plague and Pestilence, to be honest. When I played that solo, it just boils it down to the numbers. Whereas when we're playing it with people, we start to invent stupid fiction, right? We associate unrelated events together. We pattern match because that's what humans do. And we come up with this ridiculous narrative about why a thing happened, which we probably all recognize is not true, but it gives us all a good laugh, right?
Right. Right.
Right. So, and I think you need that. You need the other person present in the room, even if they're not really doing anything, just to have a laugh and make up a story and talk about what's going on. I think that makes it so much more enjoyable.
Those are both great options. I mean, yeah, I think it's great options to have two people playing a solo game and adding that, or one DM, one player, you know, has a pretty good interaction too.
Yep.
You know, and in that case, you're going to have more time for the DM to, you know, interact as the NPCs and not be waiting for player interactions. So I think as long as you have two people somehow engaged, it adds that, you know, there's another mind involved coming up with stuff that I wouldn't aspect.
Yeah. I'm reminded there's another game called, game is even maybe a stretch. There's a product out there called How to Host a Dungeon. Because it even in its own text says, like, this is kind of a game, kind of a puzzle, kind of a simulator, whatever.
Right.
The interesting thing about this is it's a bunch of charts and random stuff, and you do some map making. And the idea is it sort of creates a simulator of the creation of a mega dungeon.
Right. Right.
The end, the interesting thing is that the end output is you have the bones of a mega dungeon mapped out with all the entities that live in there, and you could then build that into a classic D&D mega dungeon if you wanted to.
And specifically what you're generating is I've only used it once. Maybe you've used it once or twice. You're doing the side view multi-level relationship thing is what you're developing, right?
Right.
Including all the history, right? Including the history of things that used to be there and aren't there anymore.
Right, right. Yep. Yep. So yeah, basically you're starting from a blank page, and then you're procedurally generating all this stuff. You're not really room by room mapping out what you know the dwarf crystal caves look like. You have one circle that says dwarf crystal caves.
Right.
So you could imagine that it is the outline that you could then eventually evolve into a full fledged mega dungeon. So I've played it a couple times, and I played it at least once or maybe twice with another person. Yeah, twice I think with other people. And playing with other people was just so much more enjoyable as its own experience, right?
Okay.
If you're doing it just because you want to generate content for your own D&D game, great, go for it. It's a fun way to do that, and you're going to come up with something you never imagined. But doing it with another person is super fun because, again, you'll just add all this extra bits that are not in the rules anywhere.
Okay, I have only... So How to Host a Dungeon, I have only run that just totally by myself. So I actually don't have the experience with somebody else. Did you actually ever take that and turn it into a full blown room by room dungeon?
I did not. I did not. I used it once, honestly, actually to generate the background for a video game that I was developing.
Okay.
Which is really weird, but that was a thing I did for fun.
Great.
I played it once with our friend BJ, and the end result was he was like really gung-ho. Well, I'm going to develop this into a big dungeon. This is amazing. I'm not sure that he ever got around to doing it, right? Like all of us, I think, had a million projects, and just that one just never got to the front.
Sure.
But it always felt like definitely could. I just haven't done it.
Great. Great, great, great.
Yeah.
So maybe we should have advice about, like, so we've covered a lot of products that exist to support single player games. And maybe we should just discuss some thoughts about what if you were just writing your own D&D adventure from scratch. And so a couple things that I think looking at the one-on-one products is they tend to be higher level, right? So it tends to be, if you're going to have a, granted that low levels are pretty fragile in standard D&D, it could make sense to pick a significantly higher level character to make them a little bit more robust and give them extra options and have your thief skills, things that are actually possibly going to work out for you. So the published products have possibly maxed out, elves happens quite a bit. Levels 6, 8, something like that are pretty common. So you might consider picking a higher level character to make that more feasible. Other thing is you can use the standard henchmen, right? So you could give them the whole team of, possible red shirts to take the first couple blows on you. So you could implement the henchman rule according to charisma and have them come into the game with 2 or 5 or 6, allies to help them out might possibly be a thing. So then now you're back to like, you are running a whole team with one specific leader, might work out.
Now, would you advise that over, say, something like, just play a whole party? Just, you control 4 characters.
It could be. I mean, you can try. I think that most people that come to the table nowadays, they want one highlighted personality. Mm-hmm. So I feel like people might be more interested in, like, I'm the distinct leader, and I'm giving commands to a bunch of people that aren't going to run off in different directions on me. That's just kind of me guessing at that. Is that they probably want one highlighted character.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I would point out, I find it fascinating that the X-Solo gave you a character who had animal companions. And I think the interesting thing about doing animals, right, is that you know that they're not going to take the front when it comes to any kind of social encounter.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
They're there for the combat bits, but they're not going to solve the puzzle for you. They're not going to talk to the Lord of the Keep for you.
They're
a pet.
Exactly.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. The other thing that I just thought of right before the show is, this might, because sometimes I struggle with, higher level D&D with things like, maybe running a castle or, being captain of a ship, right, actually is somewhat awkward when there's just one single entity really interacting with the world, but then you bring a bunch of separate D&D players together. And okay, so I'm still hurting from the example from last year where this failed totally for me, right, of a bunch of players all trying to run one kingdom.
Yeah.
And so maybe this is your opportunity to actually have the one player be captain of a ship. And so you've got a bunch of sailors, and certainly in reality, both for us and our fantasy world, the captain has completely dominion about what they say has got to go. So they could be captain of a ship. They could be head of a mercenary squad. If you're playing a science fiction game, they could be captain of a spaceship with a bunch of people that have to take their orders. And that actually might be an opportunity to do a play style that actually doesn't work so well with 4 or 5 independent players.
You know what I really like here is I'm now formulating this idea of like doing an outdoor survival style game where you have a baron who has a castle, all right, or a high-level character who owns a castle, right? Maybe say they're 6th or 7th level. And then you stat out, here are the, dozen or so level 1 to 3 schnooks who are also there, and then a whole bunch of, like, normal humans as well. Hit them with all the problems they've got to solve, and then say, okay, well, I'm going to deploy these people to do this and these people to that, and then I'm going to personally lead this group on this one because it's important.
Yeah.
And then you roleplay that bit. And then you have some abstraction for the other ones. Okay, how did the group that you sent to go, and treat your neighbor, how did that go? Let's roll one check and say, here's how it resulted.
And I will say that when the D&D assassin class was originally created, that's totally what you have. They have a table for you hire an assassin.
Yeah.
Or it could be a thief doing espionage, and there is a table of character level versus difficulty of mission that gives you a percentage chance of just succeeding. And so the DM makes 1 or 2, adjudications, one percentile die roll determines whether they're successful or not. Now, the weird thing is that when that switched to first edition, it got turned into this really weird special attack form for the assassins have, which I always found very confusing. But when I go back to original D&D, what you just said, Paul, is that's actually what the table is originally for, is an off-stage mission by an NPC to see whether the mission was successful or not.
I mean, the interesting thing is, I feel like one of the problems you encountered was you had a table of eight people, and you said, here are six things you could do, and then they bickered about the six things, right?
Yeah.
If you have one person, and you say, here are six things that all must happen, allocate your resources.
Right.
And then choose which one we're actually going to play out, and the others are all going to boil down to one role. That actually sounds really cool to me.
I agree. That's what I should have done. I should have realized that would work great for one person.
That would be an interesting one-player game. I kind of want to play that game.
Yeah, I agree. And then, you know, if you're doing it online, you know, potentially you could have that game with one person, and then you could have another barony run by another single person, right? And maybe you do that a couple nights a week if you have time for that at the moment. And then you can actually have their actions affect each other, and you could call that a campaign. And then they might lead a war. One might lead a war against another, right? And then you've recreated the game all over again.
There you go. There you go. I almost thought for a second there you were going to say, like, you know, the group of first levels that you sent to go deal with the goblin problem to the south, then go run that with six players as a
D&D game. Right. Yes. Right.
Baron says we got to deal with these goblins.
Yeah, or have it turn into a tabletop war game, right? Maybe maybe you're sending an army, and then you have a separate war game that you run to actually see the results of the force you sent out. Yep. So. Great. So William said we just invented domain play. Right, you're right. You are correct.
Excellent.
It's a big virtuous circle.
Fantastic. All right, so Dan, any final thoughts on solo or one-on-one role playing?
You know, this could be something that you wind up doing out of a constraint because you don't have immediate access to, you know, your normal players, or again, maybe you're gonna try a virtual tabletop online for the very first time, but it might turn into a whole lot of opportunities of play forms that, you know, you wanted to try out, or, you know, particular stories or events that you wanted to try out that didn't work so well with a whole bunch of people. So it actually might be a huge, great opportunity to try that out. I've seen one-on-one play work very, very well. I love that Modulo 1. Again, all those classic modules we talked about are available on DriveThruRPG for fairly low cost nowadays. And I would highly recommend you get one of those and try one of those. I've had great experience with that.
Yeah, likewise, I would say the whole reason we played the solo game, again, it was mostly an excuse just to play with virtual tabletops. What was really nice about that was the low barrier of entry. You know, at this time when we're all stuck in our homes, my own regular D&D game hasn't played for weeks, and that's mostly a logistical problem of us just trying to figure out how to go about it. Not just the technology hurdle, but our schedules, right? We have players who have new demands on their scheduling. Maybe some parents need to watch after their kids and could only really play in the evening hours, where others still are working remotely or are required to actually still go in are still working normal hours. So there's a lot of constraints, and that changes the game a lot, and that can be difficult. We all know one of the hardest things about D&D is getting six people to agree to show up at the same place at the same time.
Yep.
So, solo or one-on-one play is just takes a lot of the variables out, and it may be an easier game to throw together, so at least you get a little, you know, social outlet to play a game.
I agree. On that point, Paul, so I'm kind of putting you on the spot because we didn't talk about this before the show. Great. Will you and I be back on Tuesday?
Absolutely. I'm actually looking forward to it. There was an idea tossed out there about we should use that as an opportunity to explore the other virtual tabletops, which I actually really like, and I would love to check out the other tabletops. I don't think we have time to throw that together for this Tuesday, so I think we'll still be on Roll 20 for this Tuesday at least.
Okay.
But I'm actually kind of looking forward to playing. You know, that's, again, it's time constrained. I think we have maybe an hour and a half of total time to sit down together and play that. And I think last time we spent an hour of that hour and a half kind of like rolling the character and figuring stuff out.
Sort of, there's your session zero, sort there's, of.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to playing it again and devoting a full hour and a half to actually exploring the castle.
I agree. So that'll be 8 o'clock Eastern time on Tuesday.
Yes, yes. And very no frills for us, so don't expect a lot of production value. But I will try to have the chat open at least so that when Dan and I come at it to an impasse, we can ask the audience to
that's break good. The time. That's good. But mostly what they will be seeing is how you and I just interact when we're alone without a camera on is what they're going to be seeing, actually.
Yeah. Which is fun.
Good point. Awesome. I will be looking forward to that again.
Great.
So remember, everybody, that, you know, thanks for tuning in to the show or listening to it later, whichever you did. So remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle Wandering DMs.
And you can also listen, as Dan said, to our show in audio-only podcast format. You can get those podcasts on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find them on various podcast carriers, such as iTunes or Google Podcasts or a variety of others. If you are listening to the show on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. That helps us a lot and helps other folks find our show.
That's right. And once again, thanks enormously to our patrons who support the show. And if you would like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. We are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.